Let's talk about physical fitness for a few minutes, and just really, what is physical fitness? I travel around the world. Last year, I was speaking in 7 countries. Already this year, in 2 countries. I'll go to Russia now, the last 2 weeks in June, to talk about physical fitness. It's almost a universal language. People are looking for ways to become physically fit because they're looking for a better quality of life. I can recall speaking in Jakarta, Indonesia, last February, a year ago, and having people coming off the streets, didn't even have a shirt on their back, no food to eat. But they come in seeking for a better quality of life. And what do we as Christians have to offer those people? We offer them not only a better quality of life here, but a life in the hereafter. We've got a message to pass on, but how many of us do it? I can recall back in the late 1940s when I was going to Falls Creek Baptist Assembly as a member of Trinity Baptist Church. And I can recall one night going down and making a dedication to Christ, dedicate my life to Christ, full-time service. And I felt I was being called into the foreign mission field to be a medical missionary to China at that time. But as I went on to pre-med and medical school, I no longer felt that calling. I felt the Lord had a different responsibility for me in life. And I have had the opportunity over the past 8 years to lecture in many, many countries and just to pass a word of witness and to witness in a different way. For example, in 1968, I was asked to work with the Brazilian soccer team. Now, you think soccer, or you think football, is popular in this country. When Brazil played Italy in the finals of the World Cup in Mexico City in 1970, there were 800 million people who watched that on television. 800 million people. They started wars in South America over soccer matches. Well, in 1968, I was invited to go to Fontainebleau, France, and while there, I had a chance to meet Claudio Concino, the trainer of the Brazilian soccer team. I presented this aerobics concept to him, and he said, well, this would be the best way to train our soccer team during the off-season for 1 year prior to World Cup play. And I said, yes, I agree. So he came to San Antonio, where I was living at the time, and for 1 month, we worked on developing a conditioning program for the Brazilian soccer team. He went back to Rio de Janeiro, announced in the newspaper that the Brazilian football team, as they call it in South America, was going to be tested on the Cooper test. And he announced the place and the time. And that afternoon, over 12,000 people turned out to watch the test. That's what they think about soccer in South America. They went on the aerobics program, and Gene Bartlett, that's the way you pronounce it. It's called aerobics. It's not acrobatics or aerobatics. It's aerobics is the name. They went on the program, but they had a problem in Brazil, too. They couldn't translate aerobics into Portuguese. And so they called it the Cooper. And now if you go to Brazil, people will ask you, have you done the Cooper? And that means, have you been jogging today? And you'd be amazed at the number of people doing the Cooper in Brazil. In fact, it was fascinating because these men were on a program for 1 year. They went to World Cup, and they won 6 consecutive matches. And I told those Brazilian soccer players, if you go get yourselves in good shape, you'll have much more strength during the second half, and you'll outplay your opponents. And wouldn't you know it, that in 4 of those 6 games that they won, winning the World Cup, they were tied at the half. The other 2 games, there are 2, they're only 1 goal ahead. And in every game, they won in the second half by an overwhelming score. And overnight, Cooper became very popular in Brazil, the Cooper Pro. If you walk down Copacabana Beach right now, Rio de Janeiro, you'll see one of the most beautiful beaches in the world. You'll see Sugarloaf Mountain off in the background. Fantastically beautiful beach. And every 400 meters, from 0 to 4,000 meters, you'll see signs that say Cooper on them, marking off the distances so people can get out and can run. My wife and I have been to Brazil at least 5 times. We were down there a couple of times ago, and we're sitting at the Copacabana Palace, right on Copacabana Beach. And we'd run that morning, and thousands of people out there running. Amazing. Beautiful place to run. We're back having breakfast, and if you know my wife, you know she's not absent. She has a lot of words to say. And so anyway, we were having breakfast, and there was an American sitting next to the window. He was from San Francisco, we later found out. And he was looking out at Copacabana Beach and seeing all those people running. And he said, look at all those nuts. And we hadn't said a word this time. And he saw that sign. It was so big, that arrow across the street. He said, Cooper, that doesn't sound like a Brazilian name. And I nudged Millie and said, get him. And he was sorry that he had said that, I can assure you. What's this all coming to? It's coming to the fact that last October 1974, because of the great acceptance of Brazilians in the program, the Cliff Barons called and said, Dr. Cooper, I want you to come to Rio. We're having a five-day evangelistic crusade that Billy Graham is conducting in the Maracanã Stadium, the largest stadium in the world, seats 200,000 people. And I want you to come down and to give a testimony on Sunday afternoon. So what did I do? I started outlining the excuses as to why I couldn't go. And oh, I had them. Right before that week, I had to give presentations all over the East Coast. And as the time kept getting closer, and I kept telling Cliff Bears, I can't go, I can't go, I can't go. To make matters worse, my father passed away during the time. We had problems there. And I was coming back from Europe from another presentation. I noticed in the newspaper they're having a meningitis epidemic in Brazil. I knew I couldn't go. Finally, about 10 days prior to the time that I was supposed to be down there, then Cliff Barrow's secretary called and said, we're sending you the tickets. And I just got hysterical. I said, no, you got it all wrong. I can't go. I'm too busy. I've got all these excuses. I said, no, I'm not going. And gentlemen, I'll tell you, for the next 45 minutes, I experienced hell on earth. You know, once you really turn your back on the Lord, there's no question in my mind, you know it as I did then. And after about 45 minutes, I was so emotional for the next 45 minutes after I made that statement that the patient I was trying to take care of said, Doc, what's wrong with you? I couldn't even talk. And after 45 minutes, I got on the phone and I said, Cliff, I'm coming, and I went. And boy, what a marvelous experience to go down there on a sunny afternoon. Just because of the acceptance of the aerobics program in Brazil, I had the chance to give a 7-minute testimony before 240,000 people, the largest Christian assemblage ever in the Western Hemisphere. 30 million people watched it on television. The letters that poured in, people who saw it. Dr. Cooper, I knew you were interested in physical fitness, but I didn't know you were a Christian. Look how the Lord can use us as witnesses. If you just apply yourself, it may be in your business. It doesn't have to be in full-time Christian work. I'm sure I've had the chance to witness to many, many, many thousands of people more than I've ever had the chance to witness to as a Baptist missionary on the field. The Lord can use you if you're committed, if you're dedicated. He can use you in many, many ways. Yes, the book was first published in 1968. After that, all sorts of things came out about the book. I can recall that the old Beverly Hillbillies had a special on jogging. And Granny had this to say, jogging ain't never helped nobody, but chicken thieves, moonshiners, and Yankees. And I can recall receiving a letter shortly after the first book came out. And this woman said, Dr. Cooper, I've done everything you've said. Well, I mean, I've walked, I've washed my diet, I've kept my weight down, and I've got high blood pressure, heart disease, and arthritis, and I'm 82 years old. What'd I do wrong? I felt like writing back and said, you must have done something wrong. This evening, a man came up and said, well, I've read about half your book. Kind of reminded me of the letter I received. A man said, Dr. Cooper, I felt so much better after reading your book. I didn't do anything, but I just felt so much better after reading your book. Nothing really gains prominence, though, until it's written up in the Reader's Digest. You may have seen this not long ago. This patient calls his doctor and says, Doc, I just don't get along well with my wife at home. What do you suggest that I do? He said, I've got the answer to that. I want you to go out and run 10 miles for 14 consecutive days. He said, all right, that's kind of hard, but I'll try that. 14 days later, he called his physician. He said, Doc, I did just what you told me to do. He said, well, did it help? The man said, how do I know? I'm 140 miles from home. Some people just don't quite get the message, and I hope you get the message tonight before you leave. People have criticized the exercise program as a means of practicing medicine. Why? Well, I think Carlton Chapman, one of the past presidents of the American Heart Association, kind of summed this up when he said, the use of exercise in the diagnosis, treatment, and rehabilitation of patients with heart disease is in a state of transition from unfounded fadism to scientific legitimacy. I want to show you some slides tonight that I think that will enable you to know that we have now bridged that gap. This has not even been published yet. Material that will show you an amazing relationship between the level of fitness, really, and what's the cardiocoronary risk factors. What is your susceptibility to heart disease? That's what I'm going to show you tonight. But you know, one of the first things that we have to do in defining fitness is just what is fitness? Fit for what? Our answer is this. cardiovascular pulmonary fitness. Fit for life. 55% of all people who die in this country die of heart and blood vessel disease. 2 million people have coronaries every year. 700,000 of those people die. Well, Doc, I'm too old to get started. I had a man in my office this morning. A man who came to my clinic for the first time 4 years ago at 58 years of age, and he was in terrible shape. He came in this morning at 62 years of age and said, I've never had a better year in my life. I never felt better than I have in the past year. We put him back on the treadmill, and he had doubled his working capacity. A man 62 years of age who has now reached the good category of fitness for men under 30 years of age. Paul W. White once said, it's fascinating to know that one can grow healthier as one grows older, and not necessarily the reverse. I'll be attending a graduation this summer. A man by the name of Floyd Schaefer, who'll be 63 years of age. A man who at 60 years of age retired. He had worked with Procter & Gamble for 34 years, been one of their executives, 60 years of age. He had the capacity of a highly conditioned young man because he didn't even run, he cycled. But he cycled competitively. And he cycled as much as 200 miles a week. But at 60 years of age, he thought like a young man. He was clear. He was bright. And what did he do? He entered North Texas State University in a doctoral program, a PhD program in plant sciences. And he graduates this summer with his PhD at 63 years of age. And he's only made two B's. All the rest have been A's. It's fascinating to know that we don't have to deteriorate as rapidly as we do in this country. The vast majority of Americans are disinterested in exercise. I'm overwhelmed by the apathy, by the indifference. And yet you go abroad and you see people that are active. You see 70, 80, 85-year-old people riding their bicycles as I did a week ago, 10 days ago in Holland. You go to the communist countries. We were traveling in the Orient last year, and I noticed a big picture in the newspaper of 110,000 Chinese youth assembled in Peking. And they were demonstrating their physical fitness to Chairman Mao. And the slogan underneath read, Chairman Mao encourages the youth of China to get fit, keep fit, and spur on the revolution. That's what our communist friends think about that. What do we do in this country? I've been invited several times to appear before state legislatures trying to encourage them to keep physical education requirements in our school system. Because we're phasing out. Look at our colleges. How many physical education requirements do we have? What is the requirement for a young boy or a young woman at the University of Oklahoma? What's the requirement at Oral Roberts University? I know that school well, as you probably know. I've worked with them for 3 years. Every student who goes to ORU is required to exercise 1 hour, four times a week, for 4 years. Oral Roberts says when a student graduates from ORU, he is spiritually fit, academically fit, and physically fit. And you can't separate them. You can't be an effective witness. You can't be effective in your work. Study just recently from Russia indicated that some 600 men were allowed time off from work to participate in a regimented type exercise program. And over the next year, they decreased the number of days absent from work because of illness tenfold decrease. We know other things occur. People become less depressed once they become physically fit. People become less of a hypochondriac. They improve their self-image once they become physically fit. I can go on for hours and hours talking about this, and we can document everything we're saying. But I want to spend just a few minutes now, and I want to show you how we define cardiovascular fitness. What we're trying to do is to build up the systems that count, the heart, the blood vessels, and the lungs. And we don't determine your fitness by just sending you a questionnaire. We actually measure the first slide. The technique that we use is this. It's a treadmill technique. While the person is exercising, we monitor the electrocardiogram continuously by means of these electrodes. We exercise the person to exhaustion. Now, you understand the treadmill is flat for the first minute, and then it's constant speed, 3.3 miles per hour. That's about a 17.5-minute mile. But then the incline is increased, and the longer you're on the treadmill, the steeper it becomes. So the longer you walk, the better shape you're in, the better cardiovascular system you have. Based on your time, you won't be able to see this well. But we classify you from very poor down to superior, up to superior. It's age adjusted. My point is this. What we're actually doing is quantifying your fitness. Over 7,000 patients have come through our clinic in Dallas in the last 4 years. Over 1,250 bits of data have been collected on those patients. And we've been able to show you a relationship between their fitness as measured by their treadmill times and coronary risk factors. For example, let's look at the first one. Let's look at resting heart rate. I would challenge you, gentlemen, to check your resting heart rate. It's a rough indication of your level of fitness. The average American male has a resting heart rate of about 70. Average American woman, about 80. In response to conditioning, it goes down. It goes down to the 50s, down into the 40s. In January of this year, we had 14 world-class runners to come through our institute in Dallas. Their heart rates were in the 30s. One man had a resting heart rate of 28 beats per minute. I'm not quite sure he was alive, but that's the lowest heart rate I've seen. All right, if this is true, as you move up the level of fitness from very poor to excellent, you would expect to show a decrease in the resting heart rate, and that's what happened. 69, 66, 64, 59, 54. And that's on almost 3,000 men. First visit, average age, 44.5 years. Yes, a relationship to some extent between your resting heart rate and your level of fitness. All right, we know that with glucose is related to diabetes. We know if a person has diabetes, he's more prone to having a heart attack. We also know that your fasting blood sugar should be less than 110. And we also know there's a perfect relationship between your levels of fitness in 2,539 men and your blood sugar. 112, 107, 105, 104, and 102. Perfect relationship. Let's look at these a little bit further. Let's look at cholesterol. Cholesterol, high blood pressure, and cigarette smoking are the most important risk factors as far as heart disease is concerned, according to the American Heart Association. If you look at cholesterol levels, which must be less than 250, preferably less than 200, and we find in men very poor, 237, then a 238, a 228, a 222, and a 217, that's the only one slightly out of line. As you get in better shape, your risk factors are going down. What's this next one? Triglycerides. What are triglycerides? Triglycerides are fats in the bloodstream. They're related not to the intake of dairy products, milk, eggs, cheese, butter, but related to the intake of that dessert we had tonight. Starches, carbohydrates, the potatoes, the bread. You may be doing everything right as far as your diet is concerned from a cholesterol standpoint, but you may be doing everything wrong as far as your triglycerides are concerned. Less than 45 years of age, triglycerides are probably more important to causing heart disease than is cholesterol. And again, in 2,549 men, your triglycerides must be less than 150, preferably less than 100, and we found 179, 172, 140, 114, and 87. Oh boy, this is amazing. This hasn't been published yet. It'll be submitted now for publication in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Because see, for the first time, we have data that can document a relationship between your levels of fitness and coronary risk factors, including your body weight. We find in 2,767 men, 196, 189, 182, 174, 167. Slide off for just a minute. But there's more behind weight than what meets the eye. What do I mean by that? May I have the lights back up there, please? We learned a long time ago that you've got to look at a man. You've got to find out exactly what his percent body fat is before you can tell him that he's overweight. Obesity is a big problem that we have in this country. At least 55 million Americans are over 15 pounds overweight. And I have people coming to me all the time wanting to get started an exercise program to lose weight. And let me hasten to say that you're not going to lose weight rapidly strictly with an exercise program. You've got a diet. In 1967, I was given the responsibility at Lackland Air Force Base of training some young airman basics who were so overweight they couldn't go through 5 weeks of basic training. They were monstrous in size. Collectively, they were called the baby whales. And if you would see them, they were appropriately named. So the commander of the base said, "Dr. Cooper, with your interest in exercise, why don't you develop a program for these boys to get them in shape for going through basic training?" I said, "Fine. I'll have them exercise 6 hours a day, 6 days a week, for 4 to 5 weeks, and we'll get them in shape fast." So we had these baby whales, monstrous in size, exercising 6 days a week, 6 hours a day, and the more they exercised, the more they ate. And they didn't lose any weight, to speak of. And then we found that if you combine a 1,000-calorie diet and 6 hours a day of exercise, that you'll lose lots of weight. Some of you may have tried it. The average weight loss in 4 weeks was 20 pounds. Forges off the waist. Went Airman Basic in 6 weeks, lost 54 pounds and 14 inches off of his weight. That's not the way to lose weight, though. The best way to lose weight is about 2 pounds per week. But you know, really, are you proud of the way you look? Are you proud of your size? I challenge my audiences with this question. Can you stand in front of a mirror and be proud of what you see? If you are, turn sideways and see if you're still proud. And if you're still proud, bounce up and down on one foot and see if you can pass the jiggle test. That's one way to determine whether you're overweight or not. There's a more sophisticated way. Let's have the next slide. Everybody has this feeling, you know, that those metropolitan standards weren't made for me because I have big bones and I can tolerate more weight than they allow me to carry. But we've solved that problem with this device. It looks like something from Jules Verne. And what it is a 7-foot vertical tank. It's called a total body volumeter. Now you're placed on this little elevator and lower down in this tank of water. The water level is right here. You're lower down until the water is at chin level. You hold your breath, go underwater, and we get your displacement. Knowing your displacement, we get your volume. Knowing your volume and your weight, we get your specific gravity. And knowing that, we can tell whether you're going to sink or whether you're going to float. Now muscle mass sinks. Fat floats. If you have trouble staying up when you swim, it's because you're lean. If your wife can float and you can, it's because she's fat. That's the difference. By using this technique, we can tell you exactly what percent body fat you are. For example, you must be less than 19% body fat to be considered lean if you're a man. 22% for a woman. 15% if you're an athlete. We had these world-class athletes in the other day. I'm talking about the Steve Prefontaines and the Frank Shorters, and so many people know these names. These are all Olympians from 1972 preparing for 76. These were Olympic distance runners. And we had percent body fats as low as 1.18% body fat. Now, I'm lean. I run 16% body fat. These men were 1% body fat. Have you ever seen a walking skeleton? Just about what they were. This is the technique we use routinely. You can imagine that there might be some anxiety associated with that test. So I always tell my technicians, ask the patients two questions. Number one, can you swim? And that's no problem because we can dump the water out of the tank and empty in 8 seconds. You're not going to drown. But the second question is more of a problem. Do you suffer from claustrophobia, from closed places? We've only had two problems I can remember in the last 4 years. The first one was a big one. He weighed 300 pounds. Now, the tank was not very large, and we physically had to squeeze him together to get him into the tank. We got him into the tank. He really wanted his ideal body weight. We got him into the tank, got him down through the neck of the tank, made our measurements, flipped the switch here to bring him back up, and the cable supporting the elevator broke. And we had a 300-pound, nude, slimy man stuck in the bottom of that tank. Oh, man, what a dilemma. Hard enough getting him in. It took three of us 45 minutes to physically pull that man out of the tank. Don't worry, if you're over 300 pounds, you come to our clinic now. We now have a winch up in the ceiling. If that happens again, we can crank you out of the tank. The second case. This man was one of my patients. He said, Doc, he said, I suffer from claustrophobia, but I sure would like to know my ideal weight. And I said, fine, I'll test you myself. So I took him out, put him on the elevator here, lowered him down under the water, water at chin level, and I heard this voice coming out of the tank. Dr. Cooper, I want out. And I said, fine. I flipped the switch to bring him out, but he was already out walking around the room. And no one to this day can figure out how that man got out of that tank. One of the technicians standing nearby said, it looked like a Polaris missile being shot out of a submarine. He blasted out of that tank. But this is motivational. For example, here's a young man from Dallas who weighed 247 pounds when he came to our clinic. He was 40% body fat. Remember, you must be less than 19. I said, Dick, you've got 47 pounds to lose. Based on you, you don't have big bones. You've got too much fat. And so he lost down to 196 pounds. But he was still 21% body fat. And he still had 9 pounds to lose. That's one example. Here's a second example of what we not uncommonly see. A man who was fat at 155 pounds. He didn't lose an ounce. But look what happened to his percent body fat. He dropped from 21% body fat down to 13% body fat. Didn't lose an ounce, but converted fat into muscle mass and took off 4 inches off of his waist. That happens, not too uncommon. We have an amazing body if we take care of it. The Lord knew what he was doing. Not a man yet has been able to improve it. It's an amazing body. We can show you this relationship between percent body fat, your level of fitness, very poor to excellent, 29, 26, 23, 20, and 18. We can show you a relationship in almost 3,000 men between your levels of fitness and your blood pressure. 132, 126, 124, 122, and 122. That's your systolic pressure. And now here is your diastolic pressures. 2,198 men. 86, 83, 83, 80, 79. You can't argue with it, gentlemen. As you move up your level of fitness, you move down in your coronary risk. And here are the 10 risk factors listed by the American Heart Association. Number one is family history. If there's a history in the family of a heart attack less than 50 years of age, it's a positive family history. Paul W. White once said, you want to prevent heart attacks, you've got to select the proper parents. And I think there is some truth to that. Number two, stress, personality, behavior patterns. Type A, type B personality. Let's stop for just a second. Are you a type A or a type B? This is the work of Friedman and Roseman. He's putting a lot of emphasis on stress. I personally think too much. But just kind of query yourself. Let me ask you these questions. A type A individual is a person who plans today for tomorrow. A type A individual is a person who salts his food before he tastes it. A type A individual is a person that just can't stand to be beaten in a competitive event by a child. A type A individual is a person who just can't stand to be caught up in traffic. Or he really is disgusted when he has to wait in line at a restaurant. A type A individual is a person who can't stand for there to be a lull in the conversation. And he finishes a sentence. My wife is a perfect type A, I'll guarantee. Some of you know her. This is a factor, yes. Stress is a factor. But Hans Selye once said, stress is a spice of life. What would life be like if there were no runs, no hits, and no errors? And I encourage the hundreds and hundreds of executives that we see and people we see in Dallas, it's not stress that kills. It's the way you handle your stress that kills. And why do you think we had 250 men who work out every afternoon between 4:30 and 7 o'clock on the way home from work? What does the average American male do when he gets off from work? Very stressed, tense throughout the day. He goes home, he picks himself a drink. He sits behind the television set, reads a newspaper, and snacks while his wife picks an evening meal. The worst possible thing you can do. So what we're encouraging people to do is to burn up the stress of the day. Paul W. White again once said, stress would kill a man dead 30 years ago. It's not stress, it's the way you handle the stress that kills. Number three, inactivity. We've talked about that. Blood pressure is a factor. Abnormal resting ECG is a factor. Obesity is a factor. Cigarette smoking. All the data now on cigarette smoking is overwhelming. 95% of the people who die of cancer of the lung have a history of cigarette smoking. You know that? 95%. It's not only that, but we're also finding out that if you smoke a cigarette and sit next to me and you blow your smoke in my face and I inhale that smoke, it's doing me almost as much harm as it's doing you. And gentlemen, that is a fact. Cigarette smoking and heart disease. We know if a person has a heart attack, doesn't stop cigarette smoking, there's 2-3 times more deaths in the 5-year follow-up. And people have heart attacks and don't stop smoking. Cigarette smoking is one of the major problems that we have in this country from a health standpoint. Did you know that if you're 45 years of age, in the next 10 years, the number one cause of death for American men, 45 years of age, for the next 10 years, heart disease. Number two, lung cancer. Number three, automobile accidents. Number four, cirrhosis of the liver. Number five, strokes. How many of those are related to cigarette smoking? Lung cancer? Certainly heart disease. Alcohol and cirrhosis. Seat belts, shoulder harnesses, automobile accidents. There are things that we can do to practice preventive medicine in this country to keep ourselves healthy. Those are the approaches to take. Cigarette smoking is a major factor. Cholesterol, triglycerides, and glucose. What I've shown you in the past few minutes is an amazing relationship between your levels of fitness and your blood pressure, your obesity, your cholesterol, your triglycerides, your glucose. 5 of the 10. You have to come to the conclusion that either there's no such thing as a coronary risk factor, or exercise has the potential of doing you an awful lot of good.
Finally, what type of exercise are we talking about? We tried to answer this question when I was in the Air Force back in the early 1960s. We had to answer the question, what type of exercise, number one?
There is some truth to that. Number two, stress, personality, behavior patterns. Type A, type B personality. Let's stop for just a second. Are you a type A or a type B? This is the work of Friedman and Roseman. He's putting a lot of emphasis on stress. I personally think too much. But just kind of query yourself. Let me ask you these questions. A type A individual is a person who plans today for tomorrow. A type A individual is a person who salts his food before he tastes it. A type A individual is a person that just can't stand to be beaten in a competitive event by a child. A type A individual is a person who just can't stand to be caught up in traffic. Or he really is disgusted when he has to wait in line in a restaurant. A type A individual is a person who can't stand for there to be a lull in the conversation. And he finishes a sentence. My wife is a perfect type A, I'll guarantee you. Some of you know it. This is a factor, yes. Stress is a factor. But Hans Selye once said, stress is a spice of life. What would life be like if there were no runs, no hits, and no errands? And I encourage the hundreds and hundreds of executives that we see, and people we see in Dallas, it's not stress that kills. It's the way you handle your stress that kills. And why do you think we have 250 men who work out every afternoon between 4:30 and 7 o'clock? On the way home from work, what does the average American male do when he gets off from work? He's very stressed, tense throughout the day. He goes home, he picks himself a drink. He sits behind the television set, reads the newspaper, and snacks while his wife picks an evening meal. The worst possible thing you can do. So what we're encouraging people to do is to burn up the stress of the day. Paul W. White again once said, stress would kill him and dead 30 years ago. It's not stress, it's the way you handle the stress that kills. Number three, inactivity. We've talked about that. Blood pressure is a factor. Abnormal resting ECG is a factor. Obesity is a factor. Cigarette smoking. All the data now on cigarette smoking is overwhelming. 95% of the people who die of cancer of the lung have a history of cigarette smoking. You know that? 95%. It's not only that, but we're also finding out that if you smoke a cigarette and sit next to me and you blow your smoke in my face and I inhale that smoke, it's doing me almost as much harm as it's doing you. And gentlemen, that is a fact. Cigarette smoking and heart disease. We know if a person has a heart attack, doesn't stop cigarette smoking, there's 2-3 times more deaths in the 5-year follow-up than people have heart attacks and don't stop smoking. Cigarette smoking is one of the major problems that we have in this country from a health standpoint. Did you know that if you're 45 years of age, in the next 10 years, the number one cause of death for American men, 45 years of age, for the next 10 years, heart disease. Number two, lung cancer. Number three, automobile accidents. Number four, cirrhosis of the liver. Number five, strokes. How many of those are related to cigarette smoking? Lung cancer, certainly heart disease, alcohol and cirrhosis, seat belts, shoulder harnesses, automobile accidents. There are things that we can do to practice preventive medicine in this country to keep ourselves healthy. Those are the approaches to take. Cigarette smoking is a major factor. Cholesterol, triglycerides, and glucose. What I've shown you in the past few minutes is an amazing relationship between your levels of fitness and your blood pressure, your obesity, your cholesterol, your triglycerides, and glucose. 5 out of 10. You have to come to the conclusion that either there's no such thing as a coronary risk factor, or exercise has the potential of doing you an awful lot of good. Finally, what type of exercise are we talking about? We tried to answer this question when I was in the Air Force back in the early 1960s. We had to answer the question, what type of exercise, number one? How do we compare exercises, number two? And how much exercise is necessary? The very critical question. We found out that isometric exercises, where you contract muscles and don't move joints, do nothing for the cardiovascular system. Calisthenics, weightlifting, exercises of that type do very little for the cardiovascular system. It has to be a sustained type of activity, and this is where I strongly recommend LSD. Listen carefully. Long, slow distance. Those of you shaking your heads know what I'm talking about. This is a way to get in shape safely. Long, slow distance. We looked at walking and running. How do you compare walking with running? By determining the energy cost by means of that treadmill test.
you walk a mile in 20 minutes, you'll burn 3.4 kilocalories per minute. That's, you know, if you walk a mile in 20 minutes, you're only burning a total of 68 calories. Your wife wants to go out and exercise to lose weight. She walks a mile at night. She comes back in. She's thirsty. And she drinks a Coca-Cola. She's burnt up 68 calories. And she replaces 140 calories. You can't lose weight that way. Even running. Mile 615 only burns 16.6 kilocalories per minute. About 100 calories. That Coke is still ruining you. Because you're still behind. But we discovered back in the 60s that you can measure the oxygen cost of these activities, and it ended up in a nice little multiple of 7. 7, 14, 21, 28, 35, and 42. And that multiple of 7 is the basis of the aerobics point system. We give you more points for more activity. The harder the work, the more points it's worth. For example, a mile between 6:30 and 8 minutes is worth 5 points. Which walking mile between 14:30 and 20 minutes is worth 1 point. 12 to 14:30 is worth 2 points. The point system, which is used so internationally now. What about other exercises? What if you don't want to run or walk? What about what I mentioned before, cycling? We have a cyclist here tonight. I know a stationary cyclist, at least. I was asked to evaluate cycling years ago. We could have studied the value of cycling indoors, but it's not realistic because there's differences in bicycles, differences in terrain, differences in wind resistance. So we took a standard 3-speed American bike, put a telemetry system on the bike so the heart rate could be monitored continuously, used the same collection system we'd used in the lab. We had a man sitting in the back of a pickup truck, listening to the heartbeat, monitoring the wind resistance, looking at the EKG here, collecting the expired air in these bags while the cyclist was off to the side of the truck. And can't you imagine the remarks that we had with this system as we cycled around San Antonio, Texas? The most frequently asked question was, what are you feeding that guy, Doc, anyway? But that enabled us to develop a point system for cycling. Under 10 miles an hour doesn't do much, the cardiovascular system. Over 20 miles an hour is worth a point and a half per mile of continuous cycling. The single best aerobic exercise is probably this one, swimming, based on the speed, based on the stroke. An overhand crawl, 185 feet per minute, is worth 3/4 of a point per minute of continuous swimming. Side stroke, 1/4 point per minute. Competitive sports can be used in the aerobics concept. Handball, basketball, squash, based on duration, 60 minutes is worth 6 points. Football is worth 6 points per hour. Downhill skiing is worth 6 points per hour. Cross-country skiing, very popular now in this country, is worth as high as 18 to 24 points per hour. What about tennis? In the first book back in 1968, I'd awarded tennis 1.5% or 4.5 points per match. That was just the absolute figure. About 10 days after the publication of the book, I had a letter on my desk in the American Lawn Tennis Association. And they said, Dr. Cooper, you forgot two important points in awarding points for tennis. Number one, the length of the set, and number two, the skill of the players. And they were right. About 10 days after that, my secretary said, you've got a long-distance telephone call, but the man refuses to identify himself, but he sure does want to talk to you. So in my office in San Antonio, I picked up the telephone and said, may I help you? And he said, you sure can if you wrote that book. And I said, yes, if this aerobics you're talking about, I wrote it. He said, well, how many points do you award for playing tennis? And I said, 1.5% or 4.5 points per match. And he said, Doc, that ain't fair. Because I'm not a very good tennis player. And frequently I play against Ken Rosewell. And he runs me all over the court, and I know I'm getting more points than he gets. And I said, yes, sir, I agree. And he said, thank you very much, and hung up. And to this day, I still don't know who it was that called. But we changed the points, I'll guarantee. 4.5 points an hour. Singles only, players of equal ability. One final question that we had to answer. How many points do you need? Gentlemen, if you're past 80, past 70, past 60, or under 30, you got to get at least 30 points a week. I've got men past 60, past 70, past 80 getting 30 points a week. I have a 94-year-old man getting 30 points a week. He had running walks. Never felt better in his life. Today, I worked out with a man 75 years of age who walks 5 miles 5 days a week, rain or shine. Taking off 25 pounds, he says, Doc, I'm the best shape I've ever been in my life. At 75 years of age. Unbelievable what some of these people do. Every year in October, we have a race in Dallas called the Tire Cup. We invite corporate executives to come to our clinic, come to our activity center in Dallas, and to run 2 miles. And to qualify, you've got to be over 40 years of age. Sorry, over 35 years of age. You've got to be in the top 10 of your corporation, and you have to be able to run 2 miles. Last year, we had to stop our entry 6 weeks before the Tire Cup because we only handle 130. We had 30 chairmen of boards, We had 26 presidents of corporations that came down to run on that tightrope. I couldn't believe it. The winning time for 2 miles was 10 minutes and 3 seconds for these executives. Six men under 11 minutes. I ran a blazing 13 minutes and 10 seconds, 2 miles. I came in 57th of all those executives. But the most exciting thing, their average age was about 46. And I spoke at the luncheon like I'm speaking to you now. Let that know that audience. These top executives came from 12 states in our country to run the entire company. I asked them a question. How many of you men today ran the fastest 2 miles you've ever run in your life? And over 75% of those men raised their hand. Isn't that amazing? 46, 47 years of age. You don't have to grow old as rapidly as we do in this country. I'll show you some examples of why not in a few minutes. 30 points per week, but you got to start slowly. You got to start very slowly if you're starting past 50, past 60 years of age. You can be restricted to a walking program, as we do, our patients who come through our clinic. It may take you 10, 13, 16 weeks, or longer to work up to 30 points per week. You have to start slowly. Past 35 years of age, you must have a stress test of this type. You can't, you got to start extremely slow. This is the way, this is a man 67 years of age, former Surgeon General of the Air Force. Still runs 2 miles every day in about 15 minutes. Tremendous shape. That's what's so overwhelming to us, is to see what happens to these people who keep themselves in shape. And we stress them to a certain level based on their heart rate before I clear them for jogging, as you can see here. But you don't have to jog. Many of our people will walk 3 miles in less than 43 and a half minutes five times a week to get their 30 points. That's what they're trying to get. Or they may run a mile and a half in less than 12 minutes four times a week to get 30 points. But that's awfully fast for a man past 40, past 50 years of age. The vast majority of our men are doing this, 2 miles in less than 20 minutes four times a week. And that's worth 32 points. Other ways you can get your points. Cycling 5 miles in less than 20 minutes six times a week is worth 30 points. This is what you work up to. Such things as swimming 800 yards in less than 20 minutes five times a week is worth 32 points. What about competitive sports? 60 minutes four times a week, and you get 24 to 30 points. The whole meat of the aerobic concept is what you see here. You can walk, you can run, you can cycle, you can play handball, do whatever you want, but work up to 30 points a week. And Gene Bartlett, you'd have to play 180 holes of golf per week. 36 holes, 5 days a week, to get all the points that you need.
Sure, I'd try.
That was the most common statement I had in the Air Force, too, from all these officers. I'd sure like to try. But you know, people look at that. My goodness, Doc. That means I'd have to walk 15 miles a week. I'd have to cycle 30 miles a week. I'd have to run 6 to 8 miles a week. I'd have to swim a mile and a half a week just to get 30 points. That's totally unrealistic. We had the world-class athletes in the other day. You know how many points the winner of the Olympic marathon in 1972 was Frank Shorter, in America, first time in about 50 years. He's training now for the Olympics in Montreal. You know how many points he averages a week? Almost 800 points a week. You know how many points Mark Spitz was averaging in preparation for the Olympics in 1972 with his swimming? 1,300 points. No, it's your dedication. But what do you really need? What do you need to get some benefit from a coronary risk standpoint? This is what you need, gentlemen, as we've been able to look back. In 574 of those 3,000 men, we found out exactly what they were doing after they'd been stress tested. And lo and behold, those that reached a good category of fitness and had some protection from coronary disease were averaging 34 points a week. And those who reached the excellent category of fitness and had the best protection from coronary disease, averaging 50 points a week. If you just average 34 points a week, you get some protection. But you know, as long as I've been in this field, I've heard all the excuses. If you've got the will, well, there's a way, I can guarantee you. I want to show you some examples in conclusion here. People who wouldn't accept excuses. This man had never been an athlete. Started jogging at age 32. At age 39, he was finishing his 7th Boston Marathon, averaging 7 minutes a mile for 26 miles, 385 yards. His name is Warren Dowd, a physician from Harvard in Boston. This man won the Boston Marathon in 1963 by the name of André Vanderslice from Belgium, who ran the 26 miles, 385 yards, averaging 5 minutes and 12 seconds a mile. A good Oklahoma name won the Boston Marathon this year. His name was Will Rogers. And he won the Boston Marathon averaging 4 minutes and 58 seconds a mile for 26 miles, 385 yards. Billy could have kept up with him for the first quarter of a mile. Fantastic. This year in the Boston Marathon, there were 3,000 entries. And he had to qualify. You had to have run a 26-mile marathon somewhere before, averaging 8 minutes a mile to qualify. And there was a man this year in the Boston Marathon who pushed himself in a wheelchair and came in 2 hours and 56 minutes. Unbelievable. Why do I know so much about the Boston Marathon? I had the privilege of running it twice back in 1962 and 1963. My wife took that picture at the finish of the race, and all I can say is I felt about the same way I looked. It was a new degree of tiredness. And one reason I was so tired after I finished that race, I came in 1 hour behind 57-year-old Johnny Kelly, finishing his 35th Boston Marathon, averaging 6 minutes and 30 seconds a mile. Oh, Doc, I can't get started exercising. I'm too old. At age 65, Pop Kettner from Houston, Texas, was told that he better retire because he had heart disease and arthritis. But to the contrary, he started exercising. He started cycling. At age 67, he cycled from Houston to New York City, averaging 140 miles a day. That's pretty good in a car. He did it in a bicycle. I met Pop Kettner back in 1966 when he came to San Antonio to enter a bicycle race. You probably heard about the man's name was Larry Lewis. Larry Lewis was a banquet waiter. St. Francis Hotel, out in San Francisco. Got up every morning and ran 6.7 miles through Golden Gate Park, 5 days a week. Then went to work as a banquet waiter, worked 8 hours a day. Even though on the 25th of June of 1973, he celebrated his 106th birthday. The last 5 years of his life, he celebrated his birthday by running a 100-yard dash, running it primarily for the press. 25th of June, 1973, he ran that 100-yard dash in 17 seconds flat. And he still claimed at that time the world's record for the 100-yard dash for men over 100 years of age. Tragic story here, though. On the 25th of June, 1973, Larry Lewis announced to the world that he was going to retire as a banquet waiter. He had become so famous that he was offered a full-time job from Western Girl Sportswear to be a public relations man. True story. And he had to make 90 appearances around the country over the next year. I talked to him on the telephone. I knew Larry quite well. I said, Larry, I don't think it's wise. I don't really think you should stop. Well, Doc, he said, I'm going to enjoy the last few years of my life. And so he enjoyed the last 9 months of his life when he died, February 1974. You kind of wonder in retrospect if that cancer that he had had been there for a long time. But he kept himself in shape, kept the balance in his body. And maybe he was controlling the cancer. Why is it that Mormons, Seventh-day Adventists in California, have much, much less problems with cancer than other people in California? But there's a relationship the way we abuse our bodies and the possibility of cancer, cigarette smoking, alcohol, coffee, tea, stimulants. Those are things that the Mormons and Seventh-day Adventists don't use. Maybe a relationship. People say, well, I'm too young. I can't get started in an exercise program. What about this little boy, Condi Q, 4 years of age? I took that picture out in San Francisco a few years ago when he was finishing 1 mile nonstop in 10 minutes. How would you like to be outrun by a four-year-old boy? Well, I'm a young lady, as I hear so many times. I can't run because I'll lose my figure. And what about this little girl, 4 years of age or 6 years of age? She sure has a lovely figure, and she was finishing 10 miles nonstop in 93 minutes at 6 years of age. And this girl allows me to say that she's past 30 years of age. That's all she allows me to say. She's a United Airlines stewardess. And she runs full-length marathons every year. And this girl, until just a short time ago, held the world's record for marathons for women. 2 hours and 49 minutes, averaging 6 minutes and 30 seconds a mile in 26 miles. Then is Cheryl Bridges. Or then you may see a girl like the one that came into our clinic back in January 1974, who weighed 197 pounds on her 5'6" frame, mother of 4 children. Hadn't weighed less than 190 pounds since 1955 and said, Dr. Cooper, I'm going to get in shape. I'm going to lose weight for the first time in almost 20 years. Came in January just a few months ago. Weighed 125 pounds. That woman regained what so many people don't have, and that's pride in the way they look. And she said, Dr. Cooper, I had the most fantastic compliment I've ever had in my life the other day.
My husband Jim was out in the front yard working. A neighbor who lives only two houses down came walking by. Now, we hadn't seen this man in some time, and he was chatting with my husband Jim and said, "Jim, I didn't know you got married again." What a fantastic couple. No, it's not going to destroy your figure, babe, really. Without question, though, the most common complaint is this: "Well, Doc, I can't run because I can't get shoes to fit. I get blisters. I have fallen arches. I get shin splints." I used to accept that excuse when I met a man by the name of Pete Strudwick. You may have heard about this man. A man who I met the first time in 1969 at 39 years of age. He was completing 2 miles nonstop in less than 16 minutes, even though he was running without feet. Look at number 402. A few weeks from that day, he ran and successfully completed a 26-mile marathon. A man whose mother had measles during the first trimester of pregnancy. He didn't have any feet. What would you do with an excuse like that? Or what would you do with this excuse? A man by the name of Harry Cordellis came up after a presentation one night and said this: "Dr. Cooper, my name is Harry Cordellis. I'm 32 years of age. Just a few weeks ago, I ran 10 miles in 63 minutes. Pretty good for a 32-year-old man. Not too unusual. Except for the fact that Harry Cordellis has been blind since birth. And he has to run by rubbing elbows. For the fourth time this year, he entered the Boston Marathon. He was trying to break 3 hours. And the only problem he has in breaking 3 hours is he can't find a pacer fast enough to run with him." I can recall, after I first met Harry Cordellis, he said this. Sent me a letter and said, "Doc, I just wanted to let you know that I entered and successfully completed the Golden Gate Marathon. I ran 26 miles, 385 yards, and I only fell down twice." Oh, boy. These are really extremes, aren't they? But just what would you do if you had that problem? Slides off, please, nevertheless. We have been blessed in this country, our health. We don't realize how much we've been blessed until we see how other people around the world have not been blessed. I hope that I've challenged you tonight. I've concentrated on the physical. I know the majority of people here tonight are Christians. I know a lot of you. Certainly the spiritual is up here. The Lord told us to glorify our bodies, which He gave us. Our bodies are the temple of God. He's encouraged us keep ourselves fit. A good friend in Dallas, very, very fine Christian labor, but there's his name, you'd know him. He told me this the other day. He said, "Ken," he said, "I believe everything you say is right. So much that I get up every morning at 5:30 and I go to the bathroom and I put on the best running gear in Dallas. Boy, I've got the best sweatsuit, I've got the best sweat socks, I've got the best running shoes. I've got the best stopwatch, and I get in my car. And I drive 3 blocks over to your aerobic center. And we have an outdoor half-mile, quarter-mile track. 200 men exercise every morning between 5:15 and 7:30. Every morning, 5 days a week." He says, "I get over to your place, and I get the front of that car just as close to that track as I can possibly get. Just so I don't interfere with the running. And I sit there, and I time those men as they're running by. And I take notes on the good runners and the bad runners. That guy's flinging his arm too much. He's got a lousy foot stop. He's got the wrong pair of shoes. And I sit there for 30 minutes every morning. And I go home, take a shower, and go to work." Sure, that's ludicrous. And he meant it that way. But just think for a minute what he's saying. How many of us had such good intentions, but never quite made the step? How many of us go to church on Sunday? We participate in singing, read our Bible, listen to the service, go to Sunday school class, but just never really quite get committed? It's the same thing. A disciplined life is a productive life. Let me finish by quoting from the Bible. Romans 12:1. I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. That is my challenge to you tonight. Thank you very much.